listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Speaking with us from Managua, Nicaragua. Well, the G20 was certainly interesting, including the little sit-down between Trump and Peña Nieto and Trudeau, hammering out the replacement for NAFTA, or is being hailed as that. It's going to take quite some political machinations and some legislative ones as well, but that was one interesting thing, but there was a lot more going on that I think is certainly warrants some discussion.
Yeah, the G20 was very much a in one sense it was a non-event, because if you read the final declaration, there's lots of verbiage about kind of doing what everybody says they regard as good things, you know.
Right.
But, and the underneath, the nitty-gritty is very different. There's lots of differences of opinion and kind of outright opposition in some cases. Like the final declaration talks about promoting growth. Well, everybody's in favor of growth, aren't
right.
they? You know, in terms of the people at the G20, they were all on board for that.
I mean, the title of it is we're building consensus for fair and sustainable development. Well, who could possibly have a problem with that?
Right. Yeah, and it's so banal, isn't it?
Right.
And it's like the lowest common denominator. Nobody's going to kind of differ.
Yep.
But even within that, and they're obviously on the issue of climate change, and the United States has withdrawn from the Paris Agreement, as if the Paris Agreement is actually going to have you know, any play any major role in reversing the effects of climate change that are already happening. Almost everybody agrees it was too little too late anyway, but even that, the United States is withdrawing from it. So, you know, that the superficial consensus is very, very kind of, I don't know, it's like a film of something over troubled waters.
Right.
Very, very, you know, and it's just very cosmetic. And President Xi's appeal at the G20 for multilateralism, to defend multilateralism, and goes very much against the protectionist ideas of people like Bolsonaro, who wasn't at the summit, as we mentioned last week. Bolsonaro, the new incoming president of Brazil, and he gets sworn in the first days of January. I thought he was going to get sworn in December, but it's not. It's the first days of January.
Yeah.
So Bolsonaro is very much in tune with the thinking of Donald Trump about, and many people think that Bolsonaro is just a kind of somebody who's going to roll over and do whatever the United States government wants. And if Donald Trump's protectionist trade policies are going to be US policy, Bolsonaro will go along with that. He's already said that he agrees with the United States position about the need to prevent China's growing influence in Latin America. And that's a bit like the old story about King Canute. You remember that story about King Canute and this old English king who, in order to demonstrate to his nobles the limits of his power, went and started beating the sea and telling it to go back. You know, I know the king. Yeah, and it was, and people, it's just a kind of fable about the limits of power, but and it very much applies to Bolsonaro.
Right.
How are Bolsonaro and Trump going to stop the growing influence of China in Latin America or Africa or anywhere else? They're just not. Right. And a clear symbol of that was that President Xi stayed on after the summit was over and held a state visit. He had a state visit to Argentina as the guest of President Mauricio Macri, this kind of archetypal neoliberal pro-United States figure there at the head of Argentina's government. And they negotiated a bunch of deals, something like 30 agreements, covering a whole range of stuff, infrastructure, exploitation of one of the, I think it's the second biggest gas field in the world. It's called the Vaca Muerta field, and in theory it's supposed to be the second biggest gas reserve in the world. And once the projection is that once that Vaca Muerta gas field is in full flow, Argentina and the United States between them will account for 30% of natural gas production in the world. So, who signed the deal with Argentina's Macri? Was it the United States? No, it wasn't. It was President Xi of China.
Right.
So, and along with a bunch of other stuff like harmonization of phytosanitary rules, harmonization of customs stuff, harmonization of tax structures, a whole bunch of stuff directly related to the trade agenda, but also the investment agenda inside Argentina.
Right.
So what have you got there? You've got the second biggest partner in Mercosur, and at that G20, France's President Macron again told Argentina, they've been very insistent, the Argentinians, over the last 2-3 years, ever since Macri took power, on trying to close a trade deal, a free trade agreement with the European Union. And Macron, for the nth time, again told Macri, no, we're not doing that. And there are all kinds of reasons. They want to squeeze more concessions out of Mercosur, of course. But so, and that that whole trade area is now, and you've got the European Union saying no to Mercosur, and even Bolsonaro is raising the question of, and it's probably an extreme case, it probably never come to pass, but he's floated the possibility that Brazil may leave Mercosur, right, which is absolutely insane. But there you are, and that's, right, that's, that gives you an indication of his protectionist position in, as regards trade. It's a bit like the United Kingdom leaving the European Union.
Yeah, you're talking about Bolsonaro. I mean, because if Macri also met with Putin,
right? Oh, yeah.
And his joint statement talks about Mercosur and the EU. With first of all, Russia doing energy development projects, nuclear projects, all kinds of stuff, energy and railway transport. And then in food, obviously Argentina is such a powerful producer of agricultural products, and Russians like to eat. But Mercosur and the Eurasian Economic Union. I mean, while the EU is moving away from Mercosur, you have this counter trend here. This is huge because these are strategic areas of cooperation.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm glad that you pointed out the meeting that President Putin, the bilateral meeting, it was a bilateral meeting, yeah, one-on-one with Putin and Macri, and they agreed all that stuff that you just said, right? I mean, railway investment, port infrastructure investment, possible assistance with nuclear power, possible assistance with hydroelectric power. They didn't sign concrete agreements, and I think there were one or two agreements signed, but there was lots. The important thing is that here you have this right-wing neoliberal U.S. ally, wide open to the possibility of doing deals with Russia, the Russian Federation, and actually engaging in a very wide-ranging series of 30 agreements with China. So that contrasts quite strongly with the position of the president-elect of Brazil, Bolsonaro. But as we said in previous programs, we just have to see what happens with Bolsonaro once he is actually faced with the realities of power, and the realities of existing, of the inertia of the existing status quo, and how far is he going to try and roll that back. But anyway, and that's one aspect of the G20. And they also talked about reforms of the World Trade Organization, and they talked about the issue of migration in a totally unconvincing way.
Yeah.
In sum, the G20 meeting was it bore out what you and I have been trying to argue is the case for a long time, that the United States is no longer the only game in town by a long way. China and Russia are increasingly important actors in the Latin American economy, and of course everywhere else.
Right.
And what that means is that the attempts by the United States to roll back progressive governments, in the belief that that will somehow enable them to consolidate their power and influence and prestige in the region, is a lost cause. Because the economic realities, the economic imperatives in the region go completely against that.
Yeah.
So
we've been saying that for a long time, right? It's even, again, this was the genius of Hugo Chavez, and this is sort of the genius of the way China's engaged the world, that, look, we don't care what your political, economic system is or whatever, we will engage you in the areas of mutual concern, and what you do inside your borders is your business, although if there's something we can do to help, let's talk. And so, while you've had the benefits of that kind of an arrangement sort of manifesting themselves across the region over the last, 20 years now since Chavez took power, it's kind of difficult for somebody to come in, an ideological government to come in and say, you know, we resist this movement towards sovereignty and consolidation, and we want to go back to the way it was before Chavez. And so that means, by the way, we're going to do away with some of the benefits that we've had. We saw, actually, Bolsonaro start doing that with the doctors, you know, kicking right. Cuban doctors out. You know, the people are accustomed to those benefits. And since they don't come with a political cost, why on earth would you deny them to your people instead of owning them and taking credit for it?
Yeah, and I it's possible that people will look back on this G20 and see it as another kind of milestone in the progressive decline of United States power and influence in the region. Because if the United States genuinely had power and influence in the region, the outcome of the G20 would have been different. And I think that's absolutely clear. So and related to the G20, and also to what you were just talking about, the counterproductive nature of US promoted policies in the region, the president of Mexico had his inauguration. The new president took office on Saturday, December 1st, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. The fact that Mexico wasn't at the G20 was, in my opinion, very important, because while, as you pointed out right at the beginning, Trump, Trudeau, and Peña Nieto may have sat down at the G20 and said, right, this is the way we're going to manage the reorganization of NAFTA, mm. and under whatever the new name that is that they've got for it. And the fact that Andrés Manuel López Obrador took office on Saturday, and although he's made very clear that he's prepared to work within the NAFTA framework, that inside Mexico, he's going to do a whole bunch of stuff that goes completely against the kind of neoliberal globalization agenda of NAFTA and its successor that have been so destructive to the United States, but also in particular to Mexico's agriculture.
Right.
But to working people in Mexico generally. I found it very moving to read López Obrador's speech, because it's not just what he's saying, it's the style that he's brought to it. For example, he made the announcement that he's going to sell the presidential jet. And he's made a whole string of announcements addressing corruption, the kind of petty corruption that government bureaucrats in Mexico had gotten used to over the last however many decades it is. You know, you're using public resources for their own benefit. And a whole string of measures were announced by AMLO addressing that kind of petty corruption. But on the larger, from a wider perspective, looking at Mexico's economy, he's saying that there's going to be an end to privatizations. They're not going to allow the privatization, for example, of the water system. They're going to defend Pemex, the state oil company that's been ransacked by the Mexican elite and their foreign corporate partners for the last 10, 15, 20 years. They're going to engage in a strong program of infrastructure investment. They're going to reorganize the federal police and create a National Guard that isn't subject to the kind of corrupt influences that local police forces are, that have enabled they've been just one of the many factors that have enabled the kind of the flourishing of the narco drug culture and organized crime in Mexico. But I think the most important thing that I saw in all the measures that he announced was support for small and medium farmers, and he put a lot of emphasis on that, and that's absolutely fundamental, and not just small and medium farmers, but also small and medium businesses. And I can't help thinking that he's taken a leaf out of the experience of the Sandinista government here in Nicaragua, because if anything transformed the economy here in Nicaragua and made it so successful over the last 10 years prior to the attempted coup earlier this year, it was precisely that. It was the democratization of the economy in favor of small and medium farmers, small and medium businesses, and bringing in women operating micro businesses of all kinds, who previously wouldn't have had a chance of getting any credit in the bank in order to develop their small businesses. And that, in my opinion, is something that absolutely categorically turned around Nicaragua's economy and helped it grow. And AMLO looks as though he's going to bring in very, very similar measures in support of that whole absolutely crucial sector. And it's crucial in the United States as well. Small and medium businesses are the backbone of any economy.
Of course.
So, and in the case of Mexico, Lopez Obrador, he pointed out that, absurd as though it sounds, Mexico imports maize. It reached the point under the previous neoliberal governments where the home of maize, Mexico, was unable to produce enough maize to meet its domestic demand, which is, you know, and for people who don't understand the importance of that in Central America and Mexico, and that's absolutely, you know, and it's a damning indictment of the agricultural policies imposed on Mexico as a result of NAFTA. So, and but AMLO, and people call Andrés Manuel López Obrador AMLO.
Right.
And one of the important things about from a Central American point of view, and this gives me cause for huge optimism in terms of how Central America is likely to develop its own regional potential over the next few years, is because AMLO made very clear that he's dropping the kind of interventionist foreign policy promoted by the previous president, Peña Nieto, who was a member of the Lima group attacking Venezuela diplomatically and in other ways. And before Peña Nieto, it was Felipe Calderón, and before Felipe Calderón, it was Vicente Fox. And all these extremely right-wing politicians had an extremely pernicious influence on perspectives that governments and administrations in smaller countries in the region could develop.
Right.
Now, with Andrés Manuel López Obrador pushing this agenda, this very, very democratic, and democratic in the sense of how do you democratize an economy that has been put at the service for the last 30 years or more of foreign corporations? How do you democratize that economy? Mm-hmm. And that is a huge task that AMLO faces. But in his efforts to do that, he'll be setting an example on a much bigger scale that is likely to be quite similar to the example set by Nicaragua on a very small scale in the heart of Central America.
Yeah.
So Andrés Manuel López Obrador's influence and his example, and Mexico's example, is going to kind of recreate the natural leadership that this huge country, Mexico, and with all its potential, has had kind of crushed and crippled, as it were, as a result of corporate globalization. And that is going to have a profound regional effect on. I don't think people appreciate how important that is, because globalization isn't just, you know, money and finance and all that stuff. And it has profound culturally repressive effects. And this inauguration by Mexico's new president Andrés Manuel López Obrador is a kind of beacon of hope for the whole region. Now, a signal of that is that he welcomed to his inauguration Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, Miguel Díaz-Canel, the president of Cuba, and also Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, for which López Obrador was heavily criticized by the domestic right wing.
Right.
But during his address, he said, I can't remember the exact quote, but this is very important in terms of what I was just talking about. He said, here in Mexico, we are totally in sympathy and we feel ourselves to be the inheritors of Simón Bolívar and José Martí.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm just saying that.
Yep.
It's a complete change in the whole region, and it gives the lie to this ridiculous fiction that right wing pundits and commentators have tried to create of the so-called conservative restoration.
Yeah, I mean, what you're talking about being tied to the Cuban and Venezuelan revolutions, in essence, when you talk about being tied to Martí and Bolivar.
Oh, absolutely, and that's yep. We'll also see at some point in the future when he's in communication with President Daniel Ortega and the government of the Sandinista Front here in Nicaragua, we're almost certain to see very favorable references to Sandino.
Right.
You know, and all that kind of stuff. That whole ideological and kind of emotional furniture, if you like. And if you walk into somewhere and you see pictures of Fidel or pictures of Hugo Chavez, and you know what kind of space you just walked into.
Yeah, that's right. There's some language going on there for sure.
And it's like, although he's obviously not doing it physically. And what López Obrador has done metaphorically is take down all the pictures of George H. Bush, George Herbert Bush, and he's put up pictures of Hugo Chavez and Simón Bolívar, and it's like that.
Yep.
And that's what it feels like. So for people here in Nicaragua, it's a tremendous boost.
You know, I got to remember back when. The big threat, the specter of communism rolling across the Western Hemisphere out of Managua was being raised in Washington back in the 1980s. It was the political cover, the propaganda cover for the Contra War that was being conducted against the revolution, the Sandinista Revolutionary Government. And the huge threat, they even had that movie Red Dawn, you know, the Nicaraguans and Cubans invaded the United States through the southern border and took over the central part of the U.S. and Colorado and everywhere else. just to get an idea of scale, the actual influence that the Sandinista Revolution has had in the hemisphere. By example, and partnering with others, Cuba and Venezuela and Bolivia, etc. You're talking about with Nicaragua a population of 6 million people, roughly, and a GDP of maybe $35 billion. With Mexico, you're talking about a population of 123 million, with a GDP of $2.5 trillion. Larger than Argentina, for example, with a population of about 44 million and a GDP of just under $1 trillion, and on scale with Brazil, which is, you know, one of the BRICS countries, you know, like global player, which has a population of 210 million and about $3.3 trillion. So this is Mexico coming to the other side is huge, to use Trump's term.
Oh, yeah. And it's like, it's very, very significant in regional terms. Now, and whether, and AMLO's likely to play a very careful game. And he's not going to go out of his way to antagonize the United States. But, and the, just in a very steady, methodical way, he's going to roll back a lot of the malign influence that previous Mexican administrations have had in the region. And that can only be positive for ordinary people throughout, especially in Central America. So the, and we started off talking about Mexico, and I said how important it was in terms of Mexico not being at the G20 because there was a big gap at the G20. Now, President Xi, it's interesting to note that President Xi stayed on after the G20, and he had that important meeting with Macri that we talked about earlier on. But I think, I'm not sure if it's today, I think today he was going to Panama, and he was, and I'm not sure if it's a full state visit, but he's going to Panama. Because why is he going to Panama? Because Panama, I think it was about 6 months ago, 7 months ago, decided to cut off its relations with Taiwan, and recognize the People's Republic of China.
Right.
So, along with the failure of the United States to provide the kind of decisive dynamic leadership in the G20 and everything around that, you also have Xi, President Xi Jinping, going to Panama, which is, you know, and Panama is like, I don't know, it's like, it's the United States' very own offshore tax haven.
I know, home also to the canal. We got to wrap it up here because we're out of time. But maybe next week we can pick it up. I'm wondering if maybe he was there seeing if he could buy the canal on the cheap and was going to flip it to Nicaragua, just making it easier than constructing the new one. But we'll pick it up there next week because we're out of time. So Tony, thank you very much.
That next week.
Thank you very much. Take care and have a good week. We'll speak next week.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now for Community Public Radio. I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. Donald Trump bowing out of a G20 meeting with Vladimir Putin doesn't seem like a big deal, given the already poor state of affairs between the two countries. But the manner in which it was canceled over Twitter, without as much as making a courtesy call, may sting the Kremlin more than the cancellation itself. Is the mythical Trump-Putin bromance finally over? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Nicolae Petro, professor of political science at the University of Rhode Island. Professor Petro, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Nice to be here.
Now, you seem cautiously optimistic about the two countries moving forward after the Helsinki summit between the two leaders. I heard in one interview you particularly noted the tone the two presidents struck, and I agree that they seem to have found, if not a rapport, but at least some way of not purposefully offending each other. Given the recent cancellation, do you think that optimism was a bit premature?
Well, I actually wrote a piece, or at least it was entitled A Summit of Low Expectations. And that's because the personal relationship between any two leaders only goes so far. It then gets fleshed out by the experts that are brought in to finalize the details of any agreement. So it's good in principle always for people to talk. On the other hand, if the positions of the two nations are fundamentally far apart, then that's not going to go very far.
This is, at this point, it's not even about personal relations or bilateral relations between the two nations. It's simply about the diplomatic protocol. As I'm sure you know, this is something people take on both sides very meticulously. They deliberate the president's each sparing minute with great care. And here you have somebody canceling a meeting that had hundreds, if not thousands, people working round the clock without as much as even placing a call. Do you think the Kremlin would be justified in taking a bit of an offense in this case?
You can always take offense at things. That's the prerogative that people in these positions have. And you're absolutely right in the way you describe the setup. But the only person who doesn't seem to be aware of these protocols and the ramifications of deviating from them is Donald Trump himself. So what can you do? You can take offense or you can move on. I believe, or I assume that the Russian government is wise enough to simply move on and not try to make too much or read too much into this incident.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was following the discussions about that on the Russian television, and many experts point out that Russia is indeed trying to exercise what they call strategic patience. I think that's Obama's term in relation to Trump. But they also point out that Putin's patience has certain limits. Do you think Putin politically can afford to be stood up in this fashion by Trump on more than one occasion?
He's not the first head of state to be so treated. And as I recall the Twitter, and there are many of them, but the last Twitter feed from the President of the United States that I read, I actually thought it was rather apologetic. The real thing to focus on here is that the President of the United States is in a bind. And he is attacked by the political opposition, which has recaptured the lower house, the House of Representatives, and the investigation of which he is subject is also proceeding, and it's just a politically unacceptable time for him to be dealing with Russians or Chinese or Saudi Arabians or really any host of people that the Democrats in Congress can simply label as people that we should not be talking to. So the bottom line here is that Russian-American relations are hostage to American domestic politics.
Well, but I agree with you, but from the Russian point of view, the meeting in Argentina was important, particularly important in the light of the American pullout from the INF treaty. And Moscow made it clear that they wanted to discuss was specifically the issues of nuclear arms control and strategic stabilities. Aren't those issues a little bit more important than the difficulties of the American domestic politics?
I wish I could say yes, but the truth of the matter is no.
Well, that's a fair answer. Thank you for that.
That's all I can say. I mean, listen to the rhetoric of the people who are the Democratic leaders who are coming into key positions in the House and their counterparts in the Senate. What do they say other than platitudes that do not, in fact, address the real interests of the United States, which need to be addressed systematically, comprehensively, and by professionals?
Well, given what you just said, you mentioned before that in Trump's tweet, there was a bit of a, if not veiled apology, then at least an extended hand. He hinted at his willingness to meet again. Should the Kremlin take that as a platitude, as you put it, or should it indeed read something into that?
No, I don't think there's much to be read into any Twitter feed. I'm not sure what function they play now. In diplomacy, they seem to be simply a phenomenon of this president, and they have no standing, no diplomatic standing. Macron was the subject of several fierce and really directly insulting Twitter feeds by the president. And again, you can blow this into a huge incident, or you can simply say, well, that's Trump being Trump, and move on. You know, the interesting thing, the interesting outcome of all this is it brings Putin into the company of many other American allies who have been treated in a similar fashion by this president. When they get together in Macron, they can form a little, in Buenos Aires, they can come together and form a little club and share their experiences, you know, with Trump.
Well, I'm not sure Vladimir Putin will be very welcomed in that club either. But let me ask you one more thing specifically about the way Trump worded his tweet, because at first I thought he was trying to sound bossy, demanding this immediate release of the Ukrainian sailors. But then it struck me that maybe he was looking for a more non-biting reason, because he specifically cited that the meeting was canceled not over the incident in the Black Sea, which you can't really change, but rather over the detention of the Ukrainian sailors, which will be over in 2 months. Do you agree with that? Do you think he was looking for the easiest way out and perhaps most non-biting way out?
That's a very thoughtful question, but I don't think that much thought went into his tweet. I think it was just, well, what can we use that is not been resolved yet and that is still ongoing to use as a pretext for canceling this meeting, which is politically unacceptable to the president in the current domestic context. That's, I think, as far as it goes. And we also cannot know whether the Ukrainian sailors currently being detained and presumably being put on trial will be released at any point in the future. Their detention is a pretrial detention, and then we have to see what the outcome of the trial is.
Now, you called my previous question a very thoughtful one. Let me counter that with a very lame question, because I noticed in the preparation for this program that neither Donald Trump nor Vladimir Putin follow each other on Twitter. I mean, they both have Twitter accounts. Vladimir Putin does not use his as often as Mr. Trump, but they do not follow each other. Do you read anything into that? Do you think that's a statement of perhaps their political independence?
To the extent that people don't have Twitter accounts, they evoke my admiration. It suggests to me that they can think in more than 140, or I think that limit has now been extended a little bit, characters. That's a good thing. So I applaud President Putin for that. It's rather unfortunate, in my opinion, that Trump spends a lot of his time as our public servant on Twitter.
Now, our Ukrainian neighbors have presented Trump's tweets as yet another victory on their part. Is that all they can get from the Americans at this point, or do you expect other things to follow, things like sanctions and restrictions of any kind?
I think the current American Congress, both House and Senate, have never met an excuse for sanctions that they don't like. So there's always a good reason for sanctions.
Yes, but sooner or later, they have to run out of options.
No, they don't. As a matter of fact, look at the sequence of sanctions as they've been imposed. They are now totally divorced from actual actions. In other words, it's in response to actions taken months, if not years ago. That clearly indicates that it's just a kind of persistent effort to bring our displeasure with Russia, with its system of government, with the Russians, with Putin to the fore. And the reason for that is there are no negative political consequences to such an attitude in American politics. There's only pluses. Mm-hmm.
The question is, how far do you think they may be willing to go? Because the head of the Ukrainian Navy called on the international community to shut the Bosphorus to Russian ships over the incident, citing the Montreux Convention. So Ukraine is clearly trying to internationalize, to broaden the scope of this incident. Is there any chance of that happening and the Americans supporting that?
I don't think so, no. The immediate NATO response was to remind the Ukrainians that the number of NATO ships that entered the waters of the Black Sea this year has already increased by 50% compared to 2017. That's a very diplomatic way of saying no.
Okay, Professor Petrou, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Nicolae Petrou, Professor of Political Science at the University of Rhode Island. Professor, this program is called Worlds Apart, but I think we are more or less on the same page in believing that this incident is most beneficial to the Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko. But before we discuss it, let me ask you to be a contrarian and think about the possible motives why the Russians would initiate, concoct, and pull something like that.
Well, there is a Russian interest in not letting the Ukrainian assertion of sovereignty over Crimea and this spit of the Kerch Peninsula to stand unchallenged. In other words, Russia makes the claim, this is now Russian territory, and we assert our sovereignty through the implementation of these procedures of passage. The Ukrainian response is naturally to challenge that claim and to assert Ukrainian sovereignty by not recognizing that, by challenging that procedure.
Well, Professor Petrou, but this was not the first time that the Ukrainian ships were trying to sail through the Strait of Kerch. And before that, they always followed the procedure to avoid those confrontations. This posture on the side of Ukraine seems to be new then.
So this is a new approach, an incident, but it was bound to happen at some point. In other words, the next logical step in challenging the Russian claim to Crimea is to assert it is invalid in the context of existing international treaties, specifically the 2003 treaty on accord on cooperation in the Sea of Azov. And to make sure that the Ukrainian interpretation of that is acknowledged by Russia, and Russia will of course reject it as it applies to the Kerch Straits. So it could be expected that this would occur, but the reason it occurred now, and I agree with the past three Ukrainian presidents who penned a common letter on this. The reason it occurred now has everything to do with the upcoming Ukrainian presidential elections.
Now, that's the most frequent explanation that we hear. But I do want to ask you about that. But before we go there, I think from the Russian point of view, the timing of this incident is doubly sensitive, not only because of the Trump meeting, which was canceled, but also because of all the deliberations in Europe over the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, the construction of which the Ukrainians are actively trying to undermine. Do you think the Americans and the Europeans, whatever they think about Russia and President Putin, genuinely believe that the Russians were the ones to initiate this incident?
There's no way to know that. That's just a psychological, trying to explore the inner mind and psychology of politicians.
Let me try to rephrase this question then. Do you think the Russians would jeopardize both of these issues?
What I think is that the psychology and intentions, the expectations of what the other side intended to do are beside the point. We have the incident as it played out, and as I understand it, what happened followed more or less the rules of procedure and engagement on the high seas that one would expect. There's a certain leeway here as to the conditions under which ships can be stopped and boarded. If they refuse to be stopped and boarded, then upon which they can be fired upon. And lawyers should dispute that. But beyond that, there was nothing really extraordinary about this incident once it had reached the appropriate stage of conflict, the actual incident at sea itself. This was the natural, or logical, I should say, outcome of this. And these sorts of confrontations at one end of the spectrum all the way to, more rarely, thank God, incidents in which there is shooting and casualties, they occur routinely around the world.
But I think it is important to at least try to understand who, if there was anybody that was deliberately planning this incident, because if we take the Russian version of events and believe that President Poroshenko was planning, deliberately planning it all along, then the implication of that would be that he was also pushing his main geopolitical partners, both Europe and America, into a corner on Russia. He wanted to put them in a difficult position when they would have to choose between the horrible Russia and the young struggling Ukraine once again. And I think nobody likes feeling the feeling that they are being played, least of all Angela Merkel or Donald Trump. What do you think? Do you think they will pick up on his intention, if there was indeed an intention of playing them?
I've spoken in the last year to several former U.S. ambassadors to Russia, and my sense of their view is that Western powers dealing with Ukraine understand very well that Ukraine is trying to maneuver the West into a more aggressive and direct confrontation with Russia over Ukraine. So this is certainly not new. This has been the pattern, not only for the last 4 years, one could go back to previous presidents of Ukraine, most notably Viktor Yushchenko, and it is a policy that has been understood as such. The main thing to understand is that that is not a position which is necessarily uncomfortable to many Western politicians.
So you think they're totally fine? For example, Angela Merkel, who publicly at least talks about the need to solve the Ukrainian conflict as soon as possible, do you think she's perfectly fine with President Poroshenko pulling such a trick on the eve of his own presidential elections, and hopefully, perhaps at least, with the hope of dragging Europe and the United States into a direct confrontation with Russia?
I take it as a good sign that Western political leaders are aware of the desire of Ukrainian politicians to manipulate them, because then they recognize what is happening from that perspective, and they do not need to react in a knee-jerk fashion. They can actually determine what their own policies are and try to respond in a more measured and careful way to alter slightly Ukrainian policy. But no one, I think, I hope your readers should, your viewers understand, I think, that no one in this political game is naive. All the sides wish to manipulate the other side and at the same time try to promote their interests as they see them. The only way to avoid permanent conflict and confrontation is to be willing to make concessions. And that's what has been absent in this dialogue, is the willingness to make concessions in order to reach a common view and a common agreement.
You said that everybody in this field understands that everybody else is what kind of a game everybody else is playing, and yet I think really for the first time we've seen a very strong opposition domestically in Ukraine to those kind of tricks. As you mentioned, the number of pro-Western Ukrainian politicians accused Poroshenko of exploiting the situation for his own personal political gain. And yet the Ukrainian parliament did give him what he wanted, the martial law, although shortened to 1 month. Do you interpret that as more of a victory or a defeat for President Poroshenko?
I see it as a defeat. Because we have seen publicly expressed for the first time in Ukrainian politics since really the 2014 Maidan, an elite consensus against the president. Why then, you may ask, did they accept martial law at all? Well, because the context of that tells us more about the context of Ukrainian politics, namely that the current majority in the parliament, in the Rada, and of course the administration, and most of the intellectual and political elite and financial elite has to be anti-Russian, because Russia has been legally defined in Ukraine as the aggressor nation. So you cannot display a division of this kind in the face of what is defined as Russian aggression. It would be invalidating your entire political agenda. What we see in the 30-day martial law applied only to essentially from the majority Russian-speaking regions, is in fact a political compromise that they find acceptable, but that sends a very clear signal to President Poroshenko that essentially his time in office is over. I would be astonished if his ratings after this went up. I think his chances of re-election, which were very slim to begin with, are now even lower.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because people in a weak position often allow themselves reckless actions. But anyway, we have to leave it there. Professor Petrov, thank you very much for being with us today and for sharing your insights.
Thank you.
I encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages and hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.